From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Journalist Gerald Posner says the Sicilian mafia is finished as the major heroin power in America. The new power is the Chinese mafia, comprised of secret crime syndicates called triads, based in Hong Kong. Coming up, Posner discusses the research for his new book, The Warlords of Crime. Also today, we talk with poet and essayist Robert Pinsky. His new collection of essays has just been nominated for a National Book Critics Circle Award for criticism. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles guitarist Slim. Slim died back in 1959. Ed says had he lived, Slim might have stolen a lot of Jimi Hendrix's fire. And book critic John Leonard reviews a new biography of Ezra Pound. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. In 1984, writer Gerald Posner was in South America researching a book on Nazi fugitive Dr. Josef Mengele. During Posner's investigations, he met neo-Nazis who were business partners with a Corsican heroin trafficker. Posner says that while the Nazi sympathizers were reluctant to talk about Mengele, they spoke openly about an issue they thought was safe since he wasn't writing about it, the heroin trade. Although there was significant heroin cash in South America, Posner learned that the most powerful heroin empires were in Asia. After he finished his book on Mengele, he headed to Southeast Asia to start his next investigation. His new book, Warlords of Crime, is about the Chinese secret societies called triads, which are based in Hong Kong and have become the Asian equivalent of the mafia. Posner says they control the heroin trade in the U.S. The heroin they sell comes from the poppy crops of Burma, Thailand, and Laos, the area known as the Golden Triangle. During Posner's research in Hong Kong and the Golden Triangle, he traveled with both drug enforcement agencies and Chinese traffickers. He visited opium dens, jungle heroin labs, and went on surveillance missions. When a friend of mine learned that I planned to do an interview on heroin trafficking, she said, "Haven't cocaine and crack supplanted heroin?" I asked Gerald Posner to answer that question.
Heroin is the forgotten drug nowadays, which is wonderful if, in fact, you're a heroin dealer because you aren't a priority anymore for law enforcement. When you look at the facts, though, it's surprising to discover that heroin still has 500,000 to 700,000 hardcore addicts in the United States that consume somewhere about 8 tons of pure heroin a year just to maintain their addiction. So if the market never expands, you still have a $30 billion a year business at the street level. It's a bigger profit drug for the illegal syndicates than cocaine, even though we hear about cocaine more and more in the press because it affects more people.
Are heroin traffickers trying to lure back customers that they lost to cocaine?
Oh, no doubt. As a matter of fact, they're not only trying to lure back customers that they lost to cocaine, but they're very concerned in some instances about what the AIDS virus is going to do to their market. I mean, putting all moral issues aside, they look at this strictly as a business. And the federal government, the Center for Disease Control, estimates maybe 50 to 60% of those using intravenous needles as addicts may be infected with the AIDS virus. If that's true, I mean, they not only need to bring in back cocaine users, they also need to expand the market to new users. And what they're doing is they've introduced, at least Chinese traffickers have in Europe, a smokable form of heroin, quite inexpensive, about one-tenth the cost of what it would cost to inject into your arm. And it's become the rage. It's similar to crack in many ways. It's become the rage in Amsterdam and in Paris and in London. And they're just starting to pick up samples of it in New York now in the inner city, police are. I think we're going to see the spread of that in the next several years, attempting to reach new young users to the heroin market.
Yeah, they have to figure out a way to keep up their clientele without killing them off.
Exactly, exactly. And many people have an aversion. Many young users have an aversion to using needles. So making heroin smokable, which it's been for many years in Southeast Asia, should be the easiest way to do that.
Is it a more dangerous form?
Well, I mean,
equally
dangerous, maybe. I mean, you know, it's half a dozen, one in six of another. Heroin is already one of the most dangerous and addictive of all narcotics. Actually, smoking it may take a little bit longer to become addicted, maybe, you know, 2 weeks of use versus, you know, literally several days on the needle. But it is as devastating a form.
How much of the heroin market in the United States is controlled by Chinese organized crime?
Well, today a majority, and that is the largest single changeover probably in a drug market since the Drug Enforcement Administration has been keeping statistics on the area. In just 4 years ago, 1984, if you and I were talking, here in New York, the city, the largest of the heroin markets, the traditional Sicilian mafia had the majority of the market, nearly 80% of it, and the Chinese had only 3%. Today, the Chinese have some 70% of the New York market and more than 50% of the market nationwide. They've really moved in. They've taken over the bulk of a $30 billion a year business without any headlines. They've done it very quietly and much to the embarrassment of law enforcement.
One of the reasons why this time is kind of a turning point in the history of the Chinese organized crime is that Hong Kong comes into the jurisdiction of China in 1997, and a lot of the triads, the organized crime groups, are afraid that they won't be able to function under the communists, and they're already planning to leave. What does that mean for the United States?
Well, I think it means that we're going to increasingly hear about triads in the future, and they're going to become an increasing problem in this country. Terry, I think you raised the one single issue that makes this organized crime story different than any other, and that is that Hong Kong does revert back to communist control in 1997. It would be as if Sicily was going to revert to Eastern European bloc control in several years, and the major mafia families were planning to exodus, many of them coming here to the most profitable of the markets, the United States. I mean, we're talking about massive criminal organizations. The Hong Kong police estimate that there are some 300,000 members of triads, these illegal syndicates in Hong Kong. To put that in some perspective, the FBI estimates that here in the United States, the traditional Sicilian mafia is composed of about 2,000 made members. So we're talking about massive organizations. And even if only a small percentage of them end up here in the United States, we are totally unprepared in law enforcement. I think that they will be a growing and increasing threat here in the U.S.
I find it interesting that these crime syndicates are afraid of the communists. They're afraid of living under communist rule, and they think that they won't be able to function.
Well, I think that there's the major reason for that may well be that if the communists decide that they want to eliminate these crime syndicates, they certainly can do it in a way without any of the guarantees that a democracy gives to criminals, such as you don't need a subpoena in the mainland before you can kick a door in. You don't need to have any showing before a court of probable cause before you can put a wiretap on someone's phone. You don't have to have an order to show probable cause that there may be an indictment to jail somebody for more than 6 months. So the communists certainly have legal tools at their disposal that could probably eliminate what we think of as traditional organized crime much faster than Western democracies can. And the evidence that the exodus may well take place is what happened in 1949 when Mao Zedong's army swept to power in China. That's when the triads left China in mass numbers, and they went to Taiwan and to Hong Kong. It's one of the reasons they have such a lock grip on Hong Kong today. There was this mass invasion of the triads when the communists took control then. The British police were totally unprepared for them. The triads were able to take over the underworld. That same type of exodus is probably going to take place here.
My guest is Gerald Posner, and we're discussing the subject of his new book, Warlords of Crime, Chinese Secret Societies, The New Mafia. Well, you gave us a little bit of history of the triads. You say the triads have been involved with drug trafficking and organized crime for hundreds of years. Their roots actually go back to patriotic resistance groups to overthrow foreign conquerors. Could you give us a very concise thumbnail sketch of how the triads were formed?
Sure. As a matter of fact, I mean, they were formed as these patriotic resistance groups in the 1500s to overthrow the foreign rulers of China, the Manchus, and to restore an imperial Chinese dynasty to the throne, the Qings. So in the beginning, at least, there's no doubt that the triad started with good intentions, and they attracted as a result. They were secret societies because the Manchus were trying to stamp them out. They attracted millions of followers. Over a period of several hundred years, they degenerated into unofficial local governments that ran also some of the vice trades like extortion, prostitution, and gambling. By the 1900s, by the turn of the century, they had become also heavily steeped in opium, and that eventually led to heroin, as heroin was being synthesized at the turn of the century. Today, there's no such thing as a legitimate triad, whereas there was 500 years ago. Today, it's illegal to be a member of a triad inside of Hong Kong. So there's no instance in which you could look at a triad organization anywhere in the world today and say they're serving a legitimate function, they're a political organization or they're a dissident group or whatever else. Today, they only are criminal.
In some ways, the triads are very similar to the Sicilian mafia. They run protection rackets, prostitution rings, loan sharking. They have legitimate businesses as well. Are they any easier or more difficult to penetrate than the mafia has been?
Well, they certainly will be more difficult for Western law enforcement to penetrate, only because we seem to be at the same point with the triads that we may have been with the Sicilian mafia 30 or 40 years ago, and that is that we really have very little understanding of them. There are a number of dialects in Chinese of which they speak the gamut, and we have very few officers also on police forces that are Chinese officers. In New York, there are some 27,000 police and only 33 Chinese Chinese officers. In Los Angeles, with 500,000 Asians in the community, there's only one gang task force composed of 4 Chinese officers. Those numbers are preposterous. Certainly, you are not able, as law enforcement, to be able to develop effective undercover agents to penetrate these syndicates, as we have with the Sicilians, with that few number. So I think that, unfortunately, because of our lack of preparedness here in the U.S. and because of the failure to understand them and not prioritizing them earlier, we will find them to be a more difficult task to eventually take over than what the Sicilians have proved to be.
Now, I think these Chinese crime syndicates first got their foothold in the United States in the Chinatowns of major cities. Is that right, and have they since branched out?
Well, you're absolutely right. They did get their major foothold in the Chinatowns of the U.S., and although you're not going to get a local politician or police officer to tell you this, there was an unofficial agreement in many of the major cities like Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York, and Chicago regarding the Chinatowns, and that was to the elders of the Chinatowns, the leaders of what were called tongs here in the U.S., sort of the town halls. If you keep Chinatown under control and out of the headlines, we'll allow you, in return for that, to take care of your own problems. You'll be able to administer some of the local gambling halls and a little bit of prostitution and extortion, as long as it doesn't appear on the annual police reports and make crime in Chinatown look high, and as long as nobody else is affected. Chinese criminals preying only on Chinese victims. Now, that's what happened literally for over 100 years in this country, so that the tongs and some of the officials of the tongs were able to get a lock grip on the vice trades in Chinatown in an unprecedented manner. And historically, in many of the major cities, Chinatowns have the lowest reported crime rate, not their lowest crime, and that's important to differentiate. What that's allowed to happen is they've essentially been able to take over the business in the underworld in those communities unchallenged by law enforcement. And today they are branching out. We finally see in some of the major cities extortion and prostitution now affecting non-Asians. And certainly in the heroin trade, the bulk of their customers are non-Asians.
Did they ever compete, or are they competing now with the Sicilian mafia?
Well, they've taken over the heroin business from the Sicilians, but it's an unusual type of competition. There was not a street war between two major syndicates, between the triads and the Sicilian mafia for the heroin business. The war was fought inadvertently for the Chinese by the Justice Department, who's had some major successes against the Sicilian mafia in the last 5 years. Rudolph Giuliani, the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, had a successful prosecution that put in jail the 5 heads of the 5 mafia families. As well, the Justice Department had a very successful prosecution in the so-called Pizza Connection case, breaking up a $1 billion heroin pipeline. Just the other day, I'm sure many of your listeners saw in the newspapers that another 312 mafia members were arrested in a major heroin case, both here in the United States and in Sicily. Targeting the Sicilians in such a prominent fashion has not taken away the underlying crime, but what instead it has done is created this void, a gap for a new and aggressive group to come in and fill. So the question that law enforcement has been asking for several years, who's coming next? Who's going to fill this gap, the Jamaican posses, the Colombians, the Bolivians, or the triads? The answer now is the triads.
It's a terrible paradox, isn't it?
Without any doubt. But it is a paradox. But one thing that I think, and maybe this is the right point to mention this, we have to remember, although we're talking about a very dangerous group of people, and I think that their sophistication, expertise, and the amount of money that they have behind them, Hong Kong police estimate that they make $100 billion a year in profit, $80 billion a year of that from the heroin trade, and some $20 billion a year from what we think of as traditional organized crime, the extortion, the prostitution, the murder for hire, the political and civic corruption. We are talking only about a very small percentage of the Chinese people. I mean, the vast numbers of Chinese are honest, hardworking, and industrious people. And although we're talking about 300,000 potential criminals just in Hong Kong alone, we're also talking 1 billion Chinese. So I don't think that we should raise this specter and say in general that this affects most Chinese people. It's just the opposite. It's a very small number, and we have to keep that in mind at all times.
We've been talking about things that you learned about the history of the triads in Hong Kong and their international growth. Now, you had a chance to see some of the drug trade firsthand during your trips to Hong Kong and to the countries of the Golden Triangle. One of your informants, you've given the name of Benny to. He was a former gang member.
Right.
And he got you into some places that it would be very difficult for any American journalist to get into. How did he do it?
Well, I think that, eventually you become a victim of your sources almost when you're researching a book like this. And without Benny, I certainly would not have had access to not only a senior member of a triad inside of Hong Kong, but I wouldn't have been able to see, for instance, even something like an opium den, which eventually I did see. It sounds quite dramatic. It turns out to be nothing other than a very seedy and dirty room in central Hong Kong with four opium smokers inside. Just less crowded than a shooting gallery in New York, which I happened to see about 4 or 5 months after that. But Benny was able to, he has connections still to his old gang members as well as to the police, to be able to arrange what I thought was maybe one of the most interesting parts of the research, at least in Hong Kong, and that was this meeting at midnight in a discotheque in central Hong Kong with an enforcer for one of the island's largest triads. And he did not fit any of our preconceptions about what gangsters are supposed to look like. It's not the image of the Colombians or Bolivians with gold chains around their necks driving the Ferraris with a big multi-room house in Coconut Grove. And it's not the version of the very gruff Sicilians often portrayed here in television or movies in the United States. He was, in fact, a young man, quite unpretentious in most ways, without any visible weapon on him, without a bodyguard nearby. One of the things I discovered, not only through that meeting, but subsequent discussions throughout the Far East, is that one of the reasons that the Chinese triads have been so successful is they do not easily stand out as criminals. I mean, often you will end up with a case where the people arrested at the end of a multi-year investigation look more like somebody's grandfather or a banker down the road with their dark gray suit and their quiet shirts than really what we view as mobsters. And it's one of the reasons maybe that law enforcement, in the U.S. at least, has not targeted them as high priorities. I mean, we seem to be fighting a war on drugs and against crime here that is really related in many ways to a press relations war that fit for the TV cameras at the 6 o'clock news. And certainly parading before the news a couple of elderly Chinese who look very much like businessmen with half a kilo of heroin and no guns and no cash present may not fit into the 6 o'clock news as easily as getting some of the flashier traffickers. So Benny was indispensable, though, showing me that type of image change which I had to adapt to when I was eventually in the Orient.
I want to hear more about what you witnessed when you were in the Orient, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Gerald Posner. We're talking about his new book, Warlords of Crime. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest, Gerald Posner, is the author of the new book, Warlords of Crime. It's about Chinese illegal groups called, illegal syndicates called triads, which are based in Hong Kong and dominate the international heroin trade. One of the places that you visited while you were in Hong Kong is the Walled City, which is basically a slum in Hong Kong. Is it literally walled?
Well, it used to be walled. As a matter of fact, it was founded in 1117, and it was originally a salt mine, and there was a wall all the way around it, although it's not very large. It's about a football field in length by 2 football fields wide. So, you know, you're literally just talking 300 feet by about 600 feet. The wall was taken down by the Japanese during the occupation of Hong Kong during the war. They used it to build additional runways at the airport so Japanese transport planes could land. Today, the wall is unofficial in the sense that it's made up of tenements, some of them almost high-rise tenements going 10, 12 stories high, that surround this entire plot of land. And what happens is once you enter the so-called walled city, once you go through one of the doorways to one of these buildings, you literally can travel to any part of this city without ever seeing daylight again. It's interconnected by these underground tunnels that have been made over a period of literally hundreds of years. And they have their own names, they have their own lighting systems, electricity, they have sweatshops underneath that operate every several feet. Everything from gun shops to prostitution to illegal opium dens to manufacturing laboratories for heroin. It's off limits for the Hong Kong police. They've had no jurisdiction in the walled city since the British have had Hong Kong in the mid-1800s. And they've left the walled city alone, and in that way it's festered. It now has some 50,000 people living inside that small confine. According to the Hong Kong police, it's the most densely populated piece of real estate on the planet. What has happened is that the mainland Chinese have said that they will take Hong Kong back in 1997, but they don't want the walled city there anymore. They know it's a problem, it's a legal problem and a police problem, and they don't want the headache. So the British are now starting to tear down the outer perimeters. They're going to try to relocate those 50,000 people. And it is a shame because I tell you, I really do believe it would be important for Western law enforcement or even people here in the West to see what the triads have been able to do in such a small confine. They've taken that land over, and that's their largest recruiting ground probably in all of Hong Kong.
Yeah, the triads control the walled city, and it's basically a safe haven for triads. You learned a lot about how they recruit by taking a tour of the walled city.
Right. I had to go in with a police escort. You just cannot walk into the walled city. Matter of fact, nobody in Hong Kong would go into the walled city on their own. And if you're a Caucasian and walk into the walled city, I was told repeatedly you just won't end up coming out. It's not the type of thing that's done. There are too many illegal undertakings going on, and strangers just don't go inside. So I went in literally with four policemen near me, two behind, and we ended up, all Chinese officers, and we ended up taking finally what was a two-hour walk through the walled city, and it was an eye-opener. It's hard to describe in words how decrepit it is inside, how dark and what the sweatshops are like. You understand very quickly why you can buy a tie on the streets of Hong Kong for a dollar, because there's somebody inside working away on these ancient sewing machines, getting literally pennies a day for what they're doing. Children live inside there. There are schools inside the walled city. There are two Buddhist temples. And it's also very easy to understand why the triads are so successful in recruiting people, because you're living in such a hovel of poverty and misery that if, in fact, you're offered the chance to get away from all of that, maybe in doing a little bit of protection or collecting some money for one of these illegal syndicates, and that will give you some money, and you see a neighbor who leaves and comes back and finally has a little bit of cash and is able to move out of the walled city to a better part of Hong Kong, that's your largest encouragement to try to do the same thing. So young people seem to flock to the illegal syndicates because it gives them their easiest way out of this inner ghetto, and that is through funds and a little bit of money.
Let's get back to your midnight meeting with the enforcer from one of the triads. What's the most interesting thing that the enforcer told you about how they operate? There was a lot, by the way, that he wouldn't tell you.
I think, unfortunately, when we really got to interesting questions about the size of the triads in Hong Kong, or, you know, what they're doing in the heroin trade, or how they're involved in money laundering or illegitimate business, that, of course, he wouldn't even get near. I think the most interesting thing he did tell me was about the extent of the ceremonies that are required to join the triads. It's not just a simple matter of one of these youngsters saying, I want to be a triad member, and you're automatically a member. It is as difficult or more so than what we think of as joining the Sicilian Mafia. You have to be sponsored for membership by another member of the triad. Then you go through a waiting process, and the traditional ceremony is quite elaborate. It used to go over a several-day period and involved at times even life-threatening parts of the ceremony where, you know, swords would be put against somebody's chest and they would be made to stand in a very, very clumsy type of bamboo circle, difficult for them to stand up. And when they tried to stand up, if they fell on the sword and died, that would mean, according to the triad leaders, that they weren't going to be loyal members in the first place, so it was just as well that they were dead. The ceremonies have been cut down because they're more difficult to get away with now. The police look for these ceremonies, but they still involve the commingling of blood between the new recruits. The new recruits are told many, many times that if they are ever disloyal to the triad, they will die immediately. And one of the things that the Chinese gangsters are known very well for is being brutal in their elimination of informers. It's not like the Sicilians where just the informer is eliminated, but the wife and the children are allowed to live. Here, entire families are eliminated in very brutal manners, so that other possible informants, people who might be disloyal, can see that. And it is very effective at keeping up a wall of silence, which that triad official, called a red pole inside the triad, their enforcer position, told me many, many times.
You conclude your book with a lot of recommendations about what the United States might consider doing to stop the heroin trafficking and also to educate users in America about the dangers of the drug. Can I ask you for one suggestion in each category?
Sure. Certainly on the demand side, I think we need a massive education campaign about the horrors of narcotics abuse, especially when it comes to heroin. We've effectively done that with smoking in this country. In one generation, an education campaign about what cancer risks are have reduced us to the smallest smoking country in the world per capita for industrialized nations. A third of the people only smoke. We can certainly do that. I think if we can with smoking, we can do it with heroin. We also need, on treatment ends, to have enough drug treatment programs for people who want to kick heroin. In New York, there's an estimated 400,000 addicts and only 30,000 places at any time on methadone programs. That's a ridiculous number. On the supply side, the actual production of heroin, Once it gets into the powder form, I think it's too difficult to expect police forces and law enforcement to be able to interdict that powder. There's too many ways to hide it and get it into the U.S. So if there's a real solution, it's at the very source, and that's when it's grown as opium in the Golden Triangle. There are some 4,500 miles in Asia where you can see opium each spring right out in the fields. You can't hide it. It's there and it's visible. And what we should be having, I think, is a long-term program with those hill tribes to wean them off of opium as their major cash crop, and to eventually get them to grow rice and beans and coffee and alternate crops that may give them as much money. We can even subsidize them to some extent. It would cost us only $75 million a year to pay for the entire opium crop each year in Southeast Asia. Those hill tribe farmers would have the cash that they would have made from growing opium for the entire year, and then we could assist them in growing alternate crops and finding markets for those crops. I think that may be a more viable way of fighting the drug trade than trying to fight it here by grabbing kilos of heroin or cocaine as they cross our borders and then putting them on the evening news in the so-called war against drugs.
You spent about 2 years researching the Chinese triads and their dominance of the international heroin trade. When you first got to Hong Kong, how did you find contacts? We talked a little bit about the contact named Benny, who was an informant. But, I mean, how did you find sources? Had you spoken to a lot of journalists first? Did they help you out?
Right. What eventually happens, I mean, it's an interesting process. You almost shotgun the whole world in the beginning in terms of letters and contacts and telephone calls. And eventually you get further and further down the list until you get one or two people who open up to you. I mean, you don't just go into a city like Hong Kong and say, I'm doing a book about organized syndicates and the triads and who's going to speak to me and get people knocking on your door. So what I did originally is I wrote literally dozens of letters to journalists in Hong Kong as well as to police officials. And I would get a response from most of those who would say, when you come over to Hong Kong, let's meet and get together. When you actually arrive in Hong Kong, I spent about 3 weeks in meeting with not only journalists, but people inside the Hong Kong Police Department and Narcotics Control. Of those, most will just meet with you in the office and give you the official government story, and that's all you get. But eventually, you'll get one or two officers, and they will say, let's meet after work, let's have a beer, or let's have a coffee, or whatever. And after another week or two of them finally building up enough faith in you that you're doing credible work, then they may well turn you over, as happened in this case, to one of their informers. And that's really when you're off and running, in so many words, research-wise. Then that informer will meet with you and spend another week in having beers with you every evening until he feels comfortable enough that you're eventually going to be able to do the story that he wants without disclosing, you know, anything that's going to get him in real trouble. And then he'll introduce you to some of the underworld figures. So it's a slow process. And what you have to hope for is that one or two of your sources eventually feels comfortable enough with you to really plug you into the criminal end of the element. And that's what happened in this case. I was very fortunate.
Does it pose any threat to you when you're an American in Asian countries and the word gets out, if it does, that you're trying to write a book on the international heroin trade?
Well, I don't think it does unless it depends on to what extent you push. I'll give you an example. I mean, I was taken by two young Chinese heroin traffickers from northern Thailand over the border illegally into Burma, where they showed me the remains of a burnt-out heroin lab that belonged to one of these insurgent trafficking groups called the Shan United Army. That was clearly what I was supposed to see, and that was the extent of my journey into Burma with those two young traffickers. If at that point I had started to scream and rant and say I wanted to see an active heroin lab, and I wanted to meet a Chinese chemist who was converting opium into heroin, and I wouldn't leave until that was done, and I went back to Chiang Mai, the northern Thai city that I was using as a base, and started to let the word out that although I had seen a burnt-out heroin lab, I wanted to now see an active one, then you could get in trouble. I mean, a wife of a drug enforcement agent in that town was killed only a couple of years ago. The recent drug enforcement chief had to leave under threat of his life. So, I mean, these are not the type of people that will take threats to their business very lightly. And I think that if you eventually do get plugged in as a researcher, you get to see what they want you to see. It's pushing beyond that to the active parts of the business in many ways that can get you into physical trouble.
Is this a story you're going to stick with?
It is a story that I'm going to continue to follow up on, certainly, in terms of, I hope, the future to find out what happens. I mean, the government is having the U.S. Senate next year, Sam Nunn's committee, the Subcommittee on Permanent Investigations, hearings into these new groups of organized crime that are threatening the U.S., and the Chinese are among them. So I am going to follow it in that sense, because I think what happens before 97 could be an interesting development. But I hope to be on to also new stories in the year to come.
I thank you very much for talking with us about your new book. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me on your program, Terry.
Gerald Posner's new book is titled Warlords of Crime, Chinese Secret Societies, The New Mafia. It's published by McGraw-Hill. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Robert Pinsky had fantasies of being a jazz musician or a bum, but he became a poet. His new book of essays was just nominated for a National Book Critics Circle Award. Coming up, he reads and discusses his poems. Also, rock historian Ed Ward remembers guitar pioneer Memphis Slim. Slim played with deafening volume and screaming feedback years before Jimi Hendrix did. And book critic John Leonard reviews a new biography of Ezra Pound written by Humphrey Carpenter. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. The space shuttle Atlantis came down to Earth today in California, ending its secret mission that reportedly included the deployment of a spy satellite over the Soviet Union. Atlantis touched down at Edwards Air Force Base at 3:35 p.m. Pacific time, the second successful shuttle flight since the Challenger disaster. Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev has arrived in New York for his much-publicized three-day stay. It's the first time in 28 years that a Soviet leader has come to New York. NPR's Mike Schuster reports.
Gorbachev arrived with his wife, Raisa, and several high-level Soviet officials, including Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze. He made a few brief public remarks at the airport, saying the world is going through some crucial changes. Gorbachev said his meeting tomorrow with President Reagan and President-elect Bush would promote greater dynamism and dialogue in Soviet-American relations, and he said the meeting's agenda is open. Gorbachev went directly to the Soviet mission to the United Nations in Manhattan in a motorcade that was composed of more than 70 vehicles. He has no scheduled events for the rest of the day. Tomorrow, in addition to the Reagan-Bush meeting, he speaks to the UN General Assembly. And then, until Friday morning, Gorbachev will enjoy a whirl of meetings, receptions, and sightseeing. I'm Mike Schuster in New York.
President-elect George Bush today completed the list of candidates he wants to round out his economic team. Bush named longtime friend and campaign fundraiser Robert Mosbacher as Commerce Secretary, and he asked Washington lawyer Carla Hills to be Special Trade Representative. Bush also named campaign advisor Michael Boskin, a Stanford University professor of economics and a campaign advisor, to head his Council of Economic Advisers. Turning to foreign policy, Bush said CIA Director William Webster would remain in his post, and he named the U.S. ambassador to Israel, Thomas Pickering, as his ambassador to the United Nations. The Supreme Court today issued rulings affecting the rights of unwed fathers and minors with black lung disease. More from NPR's Nina Totenberg.
In the unwed fathers case, a California man named Edward McNamara was seeking to restore his parental relationship with his 7-year-old daughter, Katie. McNamara claimed that the state of California denied him equal protection of the law when it allowed his daughter to be adopted with permission of the unwed mother, but without consulting him or giving him a chance at custody. Today, the Supreme Court threw out McNamara's case, saying that he had not raised any constitutional question in the lower courts, and thus that the Supreme Court had no properly presented issue to rule on. In a second case involving black lung benefits, the court ruled that some 8,000 minors with less than 10 years' time in the mines are eligible for hundreds of millions of dollars in health benefits if they filed claims in time. The court ruled, however, that since most minors with less than 10 years in the mines did not file claims in time, they are not eligible for benefits. The ruling is expected to save the coal industry an estimated $13.6 billion in benefits. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
A federal appeals court ruled today that a law stripping governors of control over training missions by their state's National Guard units is unconstitutional. The court's split decision stemmed from a suit filed over the Montgomery Amendment, a 1986 law eliminating a requirement that governors give consent to training missions for their guard units. Minnesota Governor Rudy Perpich said it had it not been for that law, he would not have sent National Guard units to train in Central America. The Pentagon said today it has established a SWAT team of 100 computer experts who will respond to security threats such as the recent self-replicating virus that invaded U.S. defense computers. The new computer emergency response team will include technical experts, site managers, government officers, industry contacts, executives, and representatives from investigative agencies. Stocks have closed higher on Wall Street today. The Dow Industrial Average was up more than 25 points. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Back as early as 1951, Guitar Slim was experimenting with feedback and other ways of electronically distorting his sound. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward says that many people who knew him thought that if he'd lived, Slim would have stolen a lot of Jimi Hendrix's fire. Guitar Slim was based at New Orleans' famous Dewdrop Inn, where Little Richard reportedly worked for a while as a dishwasher. Today, Ed profiles Guitar Slim.
Eddie Jones is not much of a name if you want people to remember you. And early on, Eddie Jones decided he wanted to be remembered, so he changed his name.
What's the name of it, Eddie?
The name of it is Guitar Slim.
Oh, Guitar Slim, okay.
Ready?
Guitar Slim, Eddie Jones provides one of the most important links between black music's past and its present, between the blues and soul. Eddie Jones was born in Mississippi, even though on his record, The Story of My Life, he claimed to have been born in Alabama. But he became famous in the Mississippi Delta country because his guitar playing owed nothing to the local style, but instead recalled such Texas-born guitar greats as T-Bone Walker.
I'm so glad. Trouble don't last all week. I'm so glad that trouble don't last all week.
I also suspect that Slim may have spent some time in the church, although none of his biographers mention it, because on songs like Trouble Don't Last and I've Done Got Over It, he's just rewritten gospel standards.
Well, I done got over it. Lord, I done got over it. You know I done got over it. Well, I done got over it. Well, I done got over it. I done got over at last.
Guitar Slim made his first splash in 1950 when he came to New Orleans, not exactly a town noted for blues. Two things made an impression: his wild stage show and the volume at which he played his guitar. Slim was something of a technician and didn't bother with the usual amplifier. He used a modified PA system to play his guitar through because he liked the trebly sound and often used feedback in his live show. This also made him hard to record, and several labels tried and failed to capture his magic. Finally, Johnny Vincent, a legendary talent scout, asked his employer, Art Rupi of Specialty Records, if he could give it a shot, and Rupi agreed to let him try. Slim had a song ready. An angel and a devil had appeared to him in a dream, and each held a song in his hands. Of course, Slim took the devil's song, and depending on who you talked to, it took all night, all day, or 2 days to record. Vincent hired the best musicians and even bailed Ray Charles out of jail to be the piano player and arranger. And on October 16, 1953, they recorded this song.
The thing that I used to do, Lord, I won't do no more. The thing that I used to do, Lord, I won't do.
Things That I Used to Do became 1954's top R&B song, and it set Slim up. Guitarist Earl King remembers how he performed. Slim came out with his hair dyed blue, blue suit, blue pair of shoes. He had 350 feet of mic wire connected to his guitar and a valet carrying him on his shoulders all through the crowd and out into the parking lot. Man, he was stopping cars driving down the highway. No one could outperform Slim. No one except Slim himself, that is. He toured incessantly, and although he never again cut a record on the magnitude of The Things That I Used to Do, he kept experimenting, both with his guitar and with his body. How much could a person drink, anyway? His fellow musicians were flabbergasted by his alcoholic intake, and surviving photos of him performing show a man severely out of it. Lloyd, he told his bandleader once, I lived 3 days to y'all's one. The world don't owe me a thing when I'm gone. It happened soon enough. Slim had, ironically, stopped drinking when bronchial pneumonia killed him in New York in 1959, age 32. He was buried in an unmarked grave with his favorite guitar, a pioneer of soul music and a great man of the blues.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle.
Oh, how I'm suffering in my mind. Oh, you keep me worried, Lord, all the time. I try to smile with my friends all day, but nothing I do can ease my suffering mind. It hurts me so bad to be losing what I love. I cry, I cry, I cry and pray to the good Lord up above. But where can I find someone that can ease, Lord, my suffering mind?
This is Fresh Air. Poet Robert Pinsky says he has a kind of pitying mistrust toward all literary criticism. On the other hand, Pinsky also writes literary criticism. In fact, his new book of essays, Poetry and the World, has just been nominated for a National Book Critics Circle Award for criticism. Pinsky is also a professor of English at Boston University. He grew up in a small town on the New Jersey shore. In one of his essays, he writes that he's interested in the process of mythologizing and glamorizing. I asked him how that relates to writing about his hometown and growing up.
I think there's a typical relation to a provincial place, a kind of a crummy little place, where the person who grows up in it and then feels not a complete success in it, sometimes that person then becomes the curator of the place. My town, Long Branch, New Jersey, is something that still preoccupies me. Times I've been back there, it looks to me obliterated. It's just a terrible mess. The boardwalk that I remember is mostly gone. There are condos there. And it occurs to me that I'm the one who takes care of that old Long Branch of the 50s and 60s. I am still writing about it and thinking about it. It's mine now. And perhaps someone else who was in school and did very well and was happy with themselves socially and academically has accepted the change of the town. I'm still back there trying to do it over right.
Well, there's a poem that I think is a real perfect example of your description of yourself as the curator of the town. Would you read your poem, The Questions?
Sure. I probably should say that my dad was one of the many people who had stores on the main street in the town. My grandpa had a bar. My father sold eyeglasses. What about the people who came to my father's office for hearing aids and glasses, chatting with him sometimes a few extra minutes while I swept up in the back, addressed packages, cleaned the machines? If he was busy, I might sell them batteries, or tend to their questions. The tall, overloud old man with a tilted, ironic smirk to cover the gaps in his hearing. A woman who hummed one prolonged note constantly. We called her the Hummer. How could her white, fat husband, he looked like Reverend Peel, bear hearing it day and night? And others, a coquettish old lady in a bandeau, a European. She worked for refugees who ran gift shops or booths on the boardwalk in the summer. She must have lived in winter on Social Security. One man always greeted my father in Masonic gestures and codes. Why do I want them to be treated tenderly by the world now, long after they must have slipped from it one way or another, while I was dawdling through school at that moment, or driving, reading, talking to Ellen? Why this new superfluous caring? I want for them not to have died in awful pain, friendless. Though many of the living are starving, I still pray for these, dead, mostly anonymous. But Mr. Monk, Mrs. Rose Vogel, and barely remembered, that they had a little extra, something for pleasure, a good meal, a book, or a decent television set. Of whom do I pray this rubbery, low-class charity? I saw an expert today, a nun, wearing a regular skirt and blouse, but the hood or headdress navy and white around her plain, probably Irish face, older than me by 5 or 10 years. The post office clerk told her he couldn't break a 20, so she got change next door and came back to send her package. As I came out, she was driving off with an air, it seemed to me, of annoying, demure good cheer, as if the reasonableness of change, mail, cars, clothes, was a pleasure in itself, veiled and dumb, like the girls I thought enjoyed the rules too much in grade school. She might have been a grade school teacher, but she reminded me of being there, aside from that, as a name and person there, a Mary or John, who learns that the janitor is Mr. Woodhouse, the principal is Mr. Ringlaven, the secretary in the office is Mrs. Apostolakis, the bus driver is Ray.
Can I ask you one of the questions that you ask in your poem? Why do you want these people to be treated tenderly by the world now? Why do these people preoccupy you now?
It's such a mystery. It's the mystery of why we care about those we know. And I suppose the traditional religious injunction to love your neighbor as yourself, if you extend it, to love your neighbor's children as your own. And I think many of us even do strive to do that. But there's some sense in which the old lady I knew means more to me than the old lady you knew. And at some level, it's really appalling. I mean, each of us with his own little teddy bear that he liked. And I think it's worth thinking about a long time. If I could answer the question, the poem would have been called The Answers, Terry.
Well, one of the things I find interesting, though, is that when you were growing up, these people lived in the world of the adults. But now that you're older, these people live in the world of your past, the people who were the minor characters in your past. And now you're kind of excavating them in a way, maybe to better understand your past.
Perhaps so. It comes back to that interesting question of why some people become the holder of something that was. Dublin didn't think it was Joycean, to take an example of the greatest of modern writers for me. Dublin didn't feel Joycean to itself, and Joyce couldn't live there. He became an exile from it. And now Dublin is Joyce's Dublin. That Dublin is, anyway. And why that happens and how it happens is peculiar. Probably if I accepted these people and their world more entirely, I'd be back in the town selling eyeglasses and hearing aids to their equivalent. And it was some feeling of difference then that makes me ask myself what the feeling of sameness or closeness is now.
I'm sure that the bus driver named Ray and all the people who you mentioned by name in this poem would be astonished to know even that you remembered their names, let alone that you were including them in a poem.
That's part of the thrill of the poem. They'd be particularly astonished because I didn't like the principal, so I made him the janitor. And the secretary, I made the guidance counselor the secretary. I didn't care for her much either. And I liked the secretary very much. Her name was Ringleben, so I made her principal. So if they're out there, this is, I'm boss in the poem, just as you were boss in the school.
Right, this is the power that you have now.
But the other people, Mr. Monk and Mrs. Rose Vogel, were called Mr. Monk and Mrs. Rose Vogel.
Let's get back to something we were talking about before. We were talking about how you're interested in the process of mythologizing and glamorizing, and you explained that you sometimes use that to go back to the past and to penetrate the past and maybe even better understand the past. Do you do that in the present? Do you think that you mythologize and glamorize the present through writing about it?
I think everybody makes all day. I think that art is an extension of the kind of things that people do. In a housing tract, when it first goes up, the houses all look alike. And 10 years later, they're landscaped differently. They're painted differently. People have added to them differently. And as sloppy as we may look when we get dressed, we are making little works of art that are how we look that day. And for me, making poems is just a kind of very conscious and specialized extension of that making. It isn't only mythologizing and glamorizing, it's making something of it.
You've written that sometimes you're afraid that poetry has just become hobby, that it's just seen as hobby now.
I suppose that's a sour way to put something that's also one of the glories of poetry. That is, poetry isn't a commodity. We never read in the paper that a Sydney sonnet has just been sold for $3 million, the way a Rembrandt painting might have been. You know, and you memorize a poem, it's yours. And it's just as good as somebody who can buy the manuscript and hang it on their wall. And because poetry's instrument is one person's voice, and its material is words, which we all use every day, there's an extent to which poetry resists being turned into a commodity. And so if there's a glorious word for hobby, that means an art that does not easily lend itself to being bought and sold, then maybe I should accept that.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us and for reading some of your poetry.
Pleasure. Thank you, Terry.
Robert Pinsky's new book of essays, Poetry and the World, is published by Echo Press, which also published Pinsky's last collection of poems, History of My Heart. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a preview of All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. How are you?
What kind of coverage of Gorbachev's arrival can we expect?
Well, we'll hear from Mike Schuster in New York on Gorbachev's arrival at the airport, his remarks there in his first day. But we'll also hear from Michael Dobbs of the Washington Post, who arrived from Moscow the other day. He and the rest of the foreign press corps in Moscow were flown here on the Soviet Union's first attempt at a presidential press plane. The attempt, says Dobbs, was only very partially successful.
What else do you have?
We have a report also from Alex Chadwick about a General Dynamics weapons lab that's been proposed for a town in Virginia, a town where the population includes many Mennonites and Quakers. So while some see it as a source of new jobs, others are very disturbed about it.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Ezra Pound was one of the most controversial literary figures of the century. There's a new biography of him called A Serious Character by the British writer Humphrey Carpenter. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
Halfway through Humphrey Carpenter's interminable biography of Ezra Pound, I decided that if I ever finished it, I'd never read another word about the poet, and I wasn't sure I ever wanted to look at another of his poems either. It seems to me that my interest in Pound has been neurotic. I've worried his anti-Semitism and his treason like a sick tooth. I read Noel Stock's altogether too admiring biography almost 20 years ago, as if for the inside scoop on some satanic rock star. I went like a schoolboy to Hugh Kenner's pep rally for the Peace in Cantos. If Allen Ginsberg could forgive the godfather of modernism, who was I to stamp my foot? I now know more than I need to or want to. Carpenter pins him down and breaks his arm and washes out his mouth with soap. And what it all adds up to is not much more than the confounding cantos themselves, quote, a broken bundle of mirrors. A few words on Humphrey, the Oxford scribbler. He has weighed in before with books as heavy on the bathroom scale, minute-by-minute biographies of J.R. Tolkien and W.H. Auden, and a group portrait of C.S. Lewis and his Cambridge apostles. He is tireless and sometimes sprightly, reliable on fact, promiscuous in his opinions, indecently inclusive of the non-essential. He seems attracted in particular to the religious crackpot aspects of his subjects. He went on forever about Auden's theology, when the less said about Auden's theology, the better. Randall Jarrell was funnier than Carpenter and smarter, too, when he said that Auden's theological ideas are, quote, all too often on the level of those brown paper parcels brought secretly to the War Department in times of national emergency, which turn out to be plans to destroy enemy submarines by tracking them down with seals. In a serious character, an ounce-by-ounce account of Pound, the submarines are Homer and Confucius, Lee Poe and T.S. Eliot, the troubadours and the Rosicrucians, Mussolini and Social Credit. The performing seal is Ezra himself, out of his depth, gasping after any old source of energy or inspiration, any organizing principle at all that fell to shaky hand in the library at London or Paris, by the waters of Rapallo. This modernist ignorant of Marx and Freud, this critic of literature who never read the Russians, this critic of art who missed the point of Picasso, this tone-deaf composer of tuneless operas, with his theories of brain sperm and funny money, and his hatred of the democratic virus. Pull down thy vanity, he cried, and his vanity pulled him so far down that he was vile. Sure he helped T.S. Eliot and James Joyce, but he also envied and turned on them. Sure he had to pinch pennies, but his father was always there to bail him out, and his wife had a trust fund that supported him in exile and paranoia. Sure, his experiments with verse technique are of interest to poets and their critics, but far from adding up to a Bach fugue, the cantos amount to little more than a botched autobiography, old bones gnawed and some brilliant shards of the broken mirror in a handful of dust. We'd like to think of him wandering Lear-like into his madness, somehow a victim, somehow cautionary. But better minds than his also went fascist, unless we are willing to hazard a guess as to the morbid wasteland connection between modernist culture and reactionary politics. And Carpenter isn't, Carpenter can't. Give him a rest. Let him burn.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday and media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed A Serious Character, The Life of Ezra Pound by Humphrey Carpenter. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time I talk with novelist Trey Ellis. His first novel, Platitudes, is an experimental novel that parodies experimental fiction. It also parodies the conventions of contemporary black literature. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a television documentary about opera star Maria Callas. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg examines the complex rules that govern the language we use when we greet each other. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Salat, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.